loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump is throwing his weight behind a hardline anti-immigrant bill proposed in the Senate that would cut the number of people admitted to the United States by half during the next decade. Trump's war against immigrants and immigrant families is escalating. Donald Trump and both parties in Congress seem intent on blowing up the Iran nuclear arms deal by imposing new sanctions on Iran. Brazil's President Michel Temer has survived a corruption vote in Congress that would have put him on trial, but what comes next for Latin America's largest country? But first, we turn to immigration. Donald Trump is throwing his weight behind a hardline anti-immigrant bill proposed in the Senate that would see the number of people admitted to the United States cut in half. We are joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez. He is the director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Welcome back, Juan Jose.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you for joining. Well, let's just for the audience sum up what this means for immigrants. Who's going to be hurt? Are there winners and losers in this bill?
There definitely are winners and losers. And the losers, first and foremost, in a generalized kind of way, is democracy, human rights for all, because, you know, the losers are going to be primarily poor people of color, people with low working skills, farm workers, restaurant workers, cooks, etc. The winners are the racist of the world, specifically here in the United States. Those that have designed this bill with the express purpose of preventing more people from the third world from entering the country, and who promote the idea that America, through legislative efforts like this one, can become wider going forward.
Okay, Juan Jose, let me jump in and ask you real quick. We have officially a low unemployment figure in America, but really the number of people, if you look at the other employment indices, the number of people who are employed versus those who are not employed, from the adult population, there's tens of millions of people who are not employed. Donald Trump is basically saying to these people, by eliminating low-paid jobs that are now occupied by immigrants, say, from Mexico or from Central America, that these jobs will be available to American workers, those who are perhaps not employed at the moment. What's your answer to that?
Well, you know, that's absolutely false and misleading. You know, historically, you know, people who are racist have accused undocumented workers of depressing U.S. wages. That's been one of their main arguments to argue for the immediate ethnic cleansing of the country and, you know, getting rid of all the undocumented persons they could possibly get rid of. The fact of the matter remains that because low-wage workers come into America, that has contributed in a very significant way to help sustain the economy, which, but for the fact that they're here earning low wages, that allows the consumer to have access to low-cost agricultural products and other services, you know, the economy would be in far worse shape than it is today.
I hear you on that. I hear you on that. But again, the question is not just about the price of commodities by paying farm workers, say, a low wage, then perhaps that depresses the price of food and that's beneficial to everyone. I understand that part. But if low income or low paid workers, say, in agriculture in particular or in construction, if they are kept out of the country, will native born American workers actually take these jobs? And I've seen reports where many, many employers in construction and in industrial employment and in agribusiness, they fear that there will be not a replacement of some workers with other workers, but just an absence of workers. In other words, a gigantic labor shortage. Is that true?
That is absolutely true, Brian. And as a concrete example of what you just described, here in California, sometime back, I don't remember if it was 2-3 years ago, because of this ongoing debate about whether or not if undocumented persons were removed from jobs, Americans would jump at the opportunity to take over those available jobs, right? And so specifically in agriculture, out here in Ventura County, you know, which is north of L.A., about an hour away from here, what happened there is that agribusiness interest, you know, invited non-undocumented workers, in other words, American citizens, to take over agriculture jobs at a higher wage than had been earned, you know, before that time by the undocumented person. Okay, and this went on. It was an experiment. It went on for about a month or so.
What happened?
Not a single U.S. citizen went and applied for the jobs that were available. There were several hundred jobs that were advertised as being available.
Juan Jose, from your point of view, because you know the undocumented workers, you know the immigrant workers, you know their families, you represent them, you're in Southern California. Why is it that native-born workers are not taking those jobs?
Well, number one, they're very labor intensive. In other words, they're very hard to do. Number two, they paid very, very low wages. And number three, they're very, very dangerous. You know, people in agriculture have to deal, you know, with fertilizers and other kinds of chemicals that get sprayed over the, you know, the fields and so on that affects their health in very bad ways. In you mentioned construction. You know, if you look at the statistics, yearly, many workers lose their jobs or are severely injured as a result of working in those industries. And today, I mean, it is a known fact that roughly 70% of the industry depends on immigrant labor. So the reason why people do not want those jobs is for, you know, for some of the reasons that I just mentioned. And then also because, you know, they want to have jobs that offer the opportunity at good wages, you know, without the risk, you know, that your health is going to be placed in peril.
Okay, let me ask you another question. We have a lot of ground to cover. We have about 11 minutes left. President Trump has given a full-throated endorsement to the bill introduced by Senators Tom Cotton of Arkansas and David Perdue of Georgia called the Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment Act on Wednesday. I mean, that's the bill that we're talking about. I mean, what's actually in the bill and how does it affect families? In other words, a lot of people come to the United States. They come either without papers, in other words, undocumented, or they come with papers, but their relatives can't come. I'm hearing media reports that say the people who are really going to be hurt badly for this, from this new immigration policy, is families who want to bring a loved one, a son, a daughter, a mother, a father. In other words, people who might have been able to get here before won't be able to get here. Is that true?
That is correct. I mean, the whole concept on which there has been the core foundation of American immigration law over the years has been family unity. That has meant that someone that gains legal status in the United States, eventual citizenship, etc., can bring loved ones and be reunited with them legally. Under this new bill known as RACE, you know, that's not going to be possible anymore. The priority in bringing people to the country in the future is going to be to bring, you know, to prioritize skilled individuals that are English speakers. That's a second requirement. and that have special skills, work skills. So, you know, in the abstract, that might not, you know, sound like an awful thing to do, but when you deal with this issue in practical terms, what that means is that people without college degrees that are not English speakers, and say, for example, in Latin America or Mexico, a majority of the traditional immigrant that has come to this country in search of a better life is a non-English speaker, traditionally a low work skill person. And so, you know, those individuals are going to be hurt because essentially they are going to be, you know, prevented from ever having an expectation of being able to reunify with their family members.
Yeah, I can see how you're emphasizing, too, the racial or national ethnic element here. And also there's the irony of ironies, really, is that we have a part of the workforce, low-paid workers, who are not going to be able to come to work. Those jobs are not going to be taken by native-born workers. That's what you're saying, that even when the efforts were made and wages were increased, people, native-born citizens, don't want to take those jobs. But on the other hand, if you're bringing in high-skilled English-speaking people, say engineers, civil engineers, technical people, say from India, English-speaking countries, they actually will be taking the jobs of people who are already employed in the United States, because it seems to me that what this bill really does is it says to the corporate owner, say of Google, for instance, hey, we're going to make a larger, less expensive labor force available to you. So you're actually going to be able to knock people who have decent paying jobs out of the box in a way.
That is absolutely correct. I mean, see, what Donald Trump and, Tom Cotton and David Perdue did not say yesterday is that their plan would also depress wages, but not of individuals that are concentrated in low-skilled job positions. In this case, professionals, American professionals, will see their wages depressed because if I can hire someone from abroad, from an English-speaking country, Australia, or like you mentioned, India, et cetera, if I can hire that person at a lower rate, you know, that's going to depress wages.
Yeah, wages of decent paying jobs. So here we have the high tech sector being able to lower wages. I mean, there's not many good paying jobs left in America. 93% of the jobs that have been created since the 2007-2008 economic crisis caused by Wall Street bankers, 93% of those jobs have been jobs that are low wage or contractual work, jobs without benefits. So this is just going to accelerate the process of driving wages down. I want to play a clip, Juan Jose. We're speaking with Juan Jose Gutierrez, a clip from John Kelly. He was in charge of deporting people, the Department of Homeland Security. Now he's chief of staff, another general running a very big part of the Trump administration. Here's John Kelly speaking at the U.S.-Mexico border alongside Attorney General Jeff Sessions back in April. Let's listen to him, and then I want to get your reaction.
Both the Attorney General and I are serious about border security and enforcing our immigration laws. In accordance with the executive order signed earlier this year by our president, we have ended dangerous catch and release enforcement policies. We have significantly increased detainers for deportation, and we have arrested more criminal aliens.
Yeah, the deportation machine is in full throttle. And now General Kelly, and this bugs me too, Juan Jose, as long as we're talking about it. He's a general, and you have liberals now talking about liberals who hate Donald Trump and hate him for many good reasons, saying, well, we're glad John Kelly's there because he's a voice of stability. He's the adult in the room, blah, blah, blah. But he's been cracking out a deportation machine. So you have Jeff Sessions, who hates immigrants, who's a xenophobe himself, and now John Kelly in charge of the White House. Where's it all going for immigrants? And what are immigrants going to do? You had a huge movement back in 2006 for immigrant rights. Are people too afraid to come out, or will they come out? What's your estimate on both counts?
Well, several things. Number one, we have to take into account that this bill all that it's doing is spearing the worst of the Donald Trump political base. You know, these are hate mongers, individuals that would like to see every non-white immigrant out of the United States. And so clearly that's going to continue. Deportations are ongoing, and they're probably the process of this movement to deport as many individuals as possible is going to continue to rise. Now, this bill says absolutely nothing about what's going to happen to these 11 or so million undocumented workers that are said to be living and working in the United States. So without saying it, if we have this movement to deport as many people that are undocumented, throw them out of the country, and at the same time, you're not going to be allowing in the future, should this bill become law, to have low-skill, non-white immigrants to come into the country, I think that what's going to happen is that we're going to be living through a campaign of terror, of ethnic cleansing, of an effort to make America more white again, and so the question that you pose, well, what are immigrants going to do? Well, right now, immigrants, as you mentioned, or you pose the question, are they scared? Are they not going to do anything? Well, we're going through a process where immigrants, in fact, are scared. I've seen it. I can mention examples of how, but just to make the statement, yes, they're afraid. But I believe that over time, just like with everything that becomes a problem that needs to be a political problem that needs to be addressed, the movement is going to rise again.
You know, one thing I saw, Juan Jose, a couple days ago, there was a young man. He was a teenager. He's a soccer player. He's a star soccer player on a Bethesda high school, Bethesda, suburban Maryland. He and his brother went into the Baltimore office for their routine visit. He came here as an undocumented person in 2009. Under Obama's executive orders, there was some protection. They weren't going to be deported. He went in. He's a high school student. He's the soccer star. He goes into the office to check in as he normally does. But there they have ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, there. They arrested him. He's in jail right now. He's a high school student, soccer star. And his teammates, who are not undocumented, and many of them are native-born, are actually having a demonstration right this afternoon in downtown Washington at the DHS. I mean, how common is that kind of an arrest taking place? Again, we had the mom, Beatrice Morales, who's been here for decades. She was just arrested, and she has four kids.
Well, I mean, to make matters worse, I mean, that's a pretty depressing description that you make of that situation with that young man. What about this tragic incident that was reported last week in the city of San Antonio, Texas, where a smuggler of people, right, abandoned a semi truck loaded with undocumented workers at a parking lot, and so somebody heard voices, went and asked for help, and then they came. They opened the truck, and it turned out that there were people dead. In the end, I think there were as many as 10 people that lost their lives. Some almost lost their lives and needed to be hospitalized. But, the drama in this situation is and was completely incomprehensible or helps us shed light to make something so horrible a little bit comprehensible is the fact that people that were hospitalized, okay, had to then deal with the fact that immigration agents were posted outside of the hospital and they were actually arresting individuals there.
Incredible cruelty, and something that's not being reported much in the corporate media, and certainly not the stories of those who have been the victims of these kind of draconian immigration policies. But we are out of time. We've been joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez. He's the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition and a convener of the upcoming People's Congress of Resistance here in Washington, D.C. on September 16th and 17th. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump and both parties in Congress seem intent on blowing up the Iran nuclear arms deal by imposing new sanctions on Iran. We are joined from Tehran by Mohammad Mirandi. He is a political analyst and an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature, and he teaches at the University of Tehran. Welcome, Mohammad.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Before we begin, I want to play a short clip. It's from the State Department spokesperson, Heather Nauert, talking about what she says the U.S. government considers a violation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or the Iran nuclear arms deal, and that is a civilian space rocket launch. Let's listen, and then I want to get your opinion about it, if this is part of a new strategy from the Trump administration to undermine the accord without necessarily walking away from it. Let's listen to her.
We consider that to be continued ballistic missile development. We're also remain very concerned about Iran's support for terrorism. We consider this to be a provocative action, and a provocative action that undermines the security, the prosperity of those in the region and around the world as well.
All right. So that's Heather Nauert from the State Department. She's the State Department spokesperson. Mohammad, your comments.
I think the most important thing that we can derive from all this is that the United States, from the very beginning, has been standing against Iran's rights as a sovereign and independent country with regards to the launching of a satellite, which is completely legal and within the framework of international law. The United States considers this to be some sort of violation or provocation. There's nothing in the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the deal between Iran and the P5+1 on the nuclear program. There's nothing in it that, with regards to satellite technology, with regards to satellite launchers, and indeed with regards to Iran's missile defense capability. And this is something that we had in the past as well. The Iranian nuclear program has always been peaceful. And after the nuclear deal and with intrusive inspection, it was proven that there was never any sign that Iran's nuclear program was anything but peaceful. But just as back then, the United States was trying to manufacture a crisis, it is trying to manufacture a crisis today in order to gain further concessions from Iran and to put pressure on Iran. And the main reason is because Iran has an independent foreign policy. Now we see the same thing happening to the Russian Federation. The United States has imposed punitive sanctions against Russia for two major reasons. One is because of the hostility of the deep state, in my opinion, towards Trump, and they want to weaken his position and his role. And the second is the fact that the United States is trying to limit Russia's capabilities to export energy to Europe so that the United States could replace it with its much more expensive gas. So the United States, when it imposes sanctions, when it tries to manufacture crises, in the case of Iran and in the case of Russia as well, it is not at all based on reality. This is the accusations made against Russia about influencing the U.S. elections. There's no evidence for this, but the Russians are punished anyway because their interest in the United States to do so.
I'm looking at Press TV's website, Press TV of English language broadcast from Iran. First sentence is, Iran has condemned fresh sanctions imposed by the United States on the Islamic Republic, stressing that Tehran will not stand silent in the face of Washington's violation of the 2015 multilateral nuclear agreement. That's the Joint Comprehensive Plan. What does that mean? What does it mean in terms of what Iran is likely to do?
Well, my understanding is that Parliament and the government together will be passing a new law which will increase the budget of the Quds forces, which belong to the Revolutionary Guard. These are the forces that have been supporting legitimate governments in Syria and Iraq against the extremists that the United States, Saudi Arabia, and others had been supporting for years, the groups that ultimately evolved into ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-affiliate groups that we see. So the budget for the Revolutionary Guards will increase. Also, there will be an additional budget to Iran's missile defense capability, and there will also be incentives to do more trade with countries that have been sanctioned by the United States, and that basically means Russia in this particular case. In addition to that, I believe that the Iranian government will probably make inspections more difficult. They will interpret the JCPOA in a different way to make it more difficult for the United States. So, however, whatever the United States does, the Iranians are going to respond in kind. They're going to make sure that the United States doesn't get away with new sanctions and doesn't feel that it has been able to gain the upper hand against Iran, or that it's able to increase pressure on Iran or to change Iran's policy in the region due to American sanctions and American pressure.
Responding to these new sanctions, again, violating the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran's deputy foreign minister said the main goal of America in approving the sanctions against Iran is to destroy the nuclear deal, and we will show a very intelligent reaction to this action. We are definitely not going to act in a way that gets us entangled in the politics of the American government and Trump. Now, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman, Bob Corker, said, quote, "You want to break up this deal to be about Iran. You don't want it to be about the United States, because we want our allies with us." So could Donald Trump, short of ripping up the deal, go for a death by a thousand cuts by endlessly provoking Iran and then having Iran take countermeasures that the Trump administration can point to and say, see, it's Iran that's not living up to its side of the agreement? Or do you still believe that this is simply trying to exact more concessions from Iran?
Well, it could be both, and it probably is both. The United States obviously is showing its hypocrisy here, and they're very explicit about it, that they want to wreck the sanctions, but they want the Iranians to do it officially. And that's simply not going to happen. The Iranians will make life tough for the Americans. After all, Iran has enormous influence in the region. Iran has many allies in the region. It has been much more successful than the United States in its soft power approach over the past few years. We've seen American influence declining and Iranian influence rising, and that's basically because the people in the region, in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, Bahrain, Lebanon, Oman, Qatar, they're all seeing how the United States and U.S. allies are behaving, and thus they're moving closer to Iran. So Iran wields enormous influence in the region, and that will make life potentially more difficult for the United States. And I think the international community recognizes that it is the United States that is trying to wreck the agreement. So the Iranians will make life more tough for the United States, but they'll make sure that if the deal is wrecked, if it's destroyed, they'll make sure that the international community sees the reality on the ground, and that is that the United States is to blame. And if that happens, then I think the harm that will happen for the United States and the hurt will be much more for the United States than for Iran. I also think that it's very important to keep in mind that the nuclear deal, if the United States does not pull out of it, then the Iranians will not pull out of it. But if the United States tries to interpret it in a way to make life difficult for Iran, the Iranians will do the same in response. And ultimately, either the Americans are going to have to abide by the agreements or they're going to have to pull out themselves. But I think that they're not going to succeed in this attempt to be able to use propaganda against Iran and to make the mainstream media in the West show Iran as the guilty side. And already the United States has created so many enemies and has antagonized so many countries over the past few months, whether it's the EU, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, and whether it's Canada and Mexico, that it will be much more difficult than before for the United States to be able to, again, manufacture a crisis and pin the blame on Iran. But we have to keep in mind that the violation of the JCPOA began under Obama. As soon as the deal was signed, the U.S. Treasury increased the number of people who were in the sanctions list, and as well as the number of entities and companies that were in the sanctions list, which was a violation. Under Obama, new laws were passed that were in violation of the agreement, such as visa restrictions, as well as the Iran Sanctions Act. All of these were violations of the agreement. Under Trump, this trend continued. This particular law that has been passed was actually carried out both by Congress and Senate, and the Democrats and the Republicans together supported it. So it's not just the fault of Trump. It's the whole political regime in the United States that's behind this these sanctions. And the Democrats, who are close to Obama, they too signed this bill, and therefore they intentionally are violating the JCPOA, which is supposed to be a legacy of Obama.
You're absolutely right. The vote in the Senate was 98-2. Rand Paul, who's a conservative Republican, and Bernie Sanders were the only two who voted against it. Sanders said he was for sanctions against Russia, but not Iran, because it would be interpreted by Iran to be a violation of the arms agreement. And I think Sanders believes that Trump is, in fact, trying to trash the agreement. And Trump may not care what the outcome will be, because he's in some way satisfying his political base more than anything else. We're speaking with Mohammed Mirande. He's a political analyst and expert on American studies and post-colonial literature, and he teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed, President Hassan Rouhani was sworn in today for his second term. Do the new sanctions imposed by the United States, which will undoubtedly be interpreted by everyone in Iran as a violation of the American side of the deal, will it embolden some of his more, well, what's called in the United States, the hardline opponents, who perhaps thought he was making a mistake by going through with the deal in the first place?
Well, it definitely creates greater skepticism towards the United States. And already President Rouhani himself is taking a more, let's say, hardline approach himself towards the United States. Our foreign minister, Dr. Zarif, too, has been very explicit about his views on the behavior of the United States. So I think the political establishment in Iran in general is seeing the United States as dishonest and hypocritical and unwilling to abide by its side of the bargain. And this is not just Trump. This is, as I said, the Senate and Congress, the Democrats and the Republicans together move to violate the agreement in such a significant way. But I don't think it's going to harm the administration, because the administration is also working with Parliament to pass the new law, which, as I said, will be providing an additional budget, a significant increase in budget for the Guards, the Revolutionary Guards, and their support for Syria, Iraq, and as well as other countries that are fighting against the Western-backed extremists. And the government will also be spending more money for the missile defense program. So there is a consensus here. But I would also like to add another point in that this harms the United States in two more ways. It makes the Iranian population much more skeptical towards the United States in general, because the Iranians, many Iranians were saying that we should give the United States a chance. Maybe they'll change their behavior. And now, after the Iranians gave concessions, they were flexible with regards to the nuclear program. They tried to do everything possible to bring peace and stability to the region. The Iranian people see that the Americans have not reciprocated. In fact, they've been completely dishonest, and they are trying to force the Iranians to give more concessions despite the fact that they signed on to this agreement. Iran, Russia, China, these countries are going to be moving closer to each other. In fact, in the bill that's being passed, there'll be increased incentives to do trade with other countries that are under sanctions, and that would include Russia, as I said. So I think that in general what the Americans are doing is they're pushing Iran and Russia closer to each other, and major powers like China, too, who see that independent countries are being sanctioned in this way by the United States, will see that will come to recognize that they could be next. So that pushes these different countries closer to each other.
Mohammed, let me ask you in our last 90 seconds, time goes very fast here. I want to just ask you your opinion. There seems to be divergent points of view on the deal within the Trump's team, however. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said of Trump, "He and I have differences of views on things like the JCPOA, that's the Iran nuclear arms deal, and how we should use it." In our last, well, now 60 seconds, how big of a deal is it for the Secretary of State to make this view public?
Well, it could be significant, but we also know that the workings of the Trump team, the Trump regime, is very unpredictable. Trump could remove the Secretary of State very easily, just as he's done with regards to other people in the recent past. So for Iran, what's important is what the actions of the United States, not who says what. If Tillerson gets the upper hand and the United States behaves more appropriately, so much the better. If it doesn't, then it's a loss for the United States, because the international community will recognize that the United States is violating the agreement.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He is a political analyst and expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Brazil's president, Michel Temer, has survived a corruption vote in Congress that would have put him on trial. But can Temer's legislative coup government, which is part of the right-wing offensive across Latin America, really go on for much longer? We are joined from Spain by Dr. Francisco Dominguez, the head of the Department of Latin American Studies at Middlesex University. Welcome back, Francisco.
Well, thanks for having me, Brian.
I want to hear, before we really begin, a short audio clip from now-ousted, impeached President Dilma Rousseff of the Workers' Party denouncing the Michel Temer government is illegitimate. Let's listen to Dilma Rousseff.
What we have today in Brazil is a temporary government and a president elected by 54 million people. Therefore, the temporary government is illegitimate from the point of view of the people's votes. We will fight to come back.
There's a lot there, actually, in that real brief clip, Francisco. It's an illegitimate government. Her government actually won a popular vote and then was ousted by very corrupt politicians on the basis that her government was corrupt, even though she herself has never been alleged to have committed any corruption. But she also said, Francisco, that people will fight back. Are people fighting back?
Well, there have been at least two general strikes in Brazil already. And the unity among the trade union federations in Brazil, they have nine of them. One of them is called Belego, which is, you know, extremely right-wing. Even they joined the strike. In one of them, in the first one, they managed to get 45 million workers to paralyze the country who struck for political reasons, you know, against the government. And the second one was bigger because it involved the social movements. The movement is not yet strong enough to actually give the final push to it because they're still working within the constitutional framework. However, it is the government who's actually violating the constitution and the law literally every single minute of the day, day after day after day.
Tell us what actually happened in Brazil yesterday. Michel Temer, the, you know, as we're talking about, an extremely unpopular president who became the first sitting president, the first head of state to be charged with a crime, survived a vote in the lower house of Congress that would have put him in trial. How does he cling to that kind of political life?
Well, it was just by a whisker, because in his case, in the case of Temer, the situation was that there was absolutely irrefutable evidence, which was in the public domain, publicized and processed by people from the judiciary. And these actually had to be sent to parliament because of the constitutional arrangements. And I would say, I would call them the kleptocracy. They decided by sufficient numbers to save their skin. And I think the key reason for the number of votes was 173 to support him, to save him, and 146 against, with 13 absenting themselves. So what they have decided to do was actually to file away, you know, put it away, the file, or with the charges against Michel Temer, which is absolutely unbelievable. Anywhere else in the world where there is something called the rule of law, the rule of law on the basis of irrefutable evidence against corruption, which is blatant, flagrant, and, you know, an open day, should have done something about it. And because of the constitutional arrangements in Brazil, they decided by a simple vote to actually stop it. And they saved the skin. I think the key reason behind this is this. If they were to accept, and this is the number of people who are prepared to go for broke on this, is becoming smaller and smaller all the time there is pressure. If they were to accept the charges and the trial against Michel Temer, they would be completely open themselves to be liable, to be investigated, and to be tried for corruption, because just about 40 to 60% of the people in Congress actually face charges and investigations. Some of them are even being convicted of crimes of corruption. And this is, I think, is the real driving force behind saving Temer yesterday.
40 to 60% of the legislators in Brazil, you say, are guilty of corruption. Help the American audience understand what kind of corruption, because in the United States, we have something called lobbying, which is not technically illegal. I mean, it's legal, and it's not technically, you know, buying people, buying their votes. But that's the whole point of it. There's 15,000 lobbyists here in Washington, D.C., 15,000 representing corporations and banks. And they're handing out money and, you know, giving perks and privileges to the Congress all the time. What kind of corruption are we talking about in Brazil?
What it is that there's a sort of, I don't want to prolong this too long, but it's a story where Brazil went up in terms of economic growth massively from $600 billion in 2002 to $2.7 trillion in 2013. And in the process, the government of the PT, the Workers' Party governments, expanded the economy, as you could never believe it. More than 40 new universities, contracts for motorways, infrastructure of every kind, social programs, juicy contracts all around the place. And the mediators were, you know, parliamentarians contacting companies of every kind, some of them extremely big, and they were actually giving them money in order to secure the contracts. And this is what is known as the Lava Jato, the car wash investigation. And in Parliament itself, out of 513 and congressmen or congresspeople, there are more than 350 who are being investigated for corruption. And now we know that even Temer is a. This is what it is. This is the nature of it. And in the latest period, because of the continuation by the judiciary of the investigation and because of the recession that the Temer government has actually intensified for Brazil, there is not as many UCC contracts as before. So what they decided to do, they are extorting companies. And this is what Temer has done. Got a company called JBS to actually give them money in order to pay money monthly to a guy called Eduardo Cunha, who was the president of the Congress that organized the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff in order to maintain him quiet. And this was in the region, according to the information, of $30,000 a month. And the guy who was being extorted, a company called JBS, actually recorded the discussion, the conversation, and gave it to a judge. And the judge gave it to the media. And this is how we know. So there is absolutely total and absolute irrefutable evidence. And these buggers decided anyway to actually vote for him. I think the reason is they're saving their own skin. I think the political class in Brazil, the kleptocracy, do not know what to do, because the moment they allow just that little bit of democracy, they know that Lula will win the election in 2018. And even if Temer has been able to save his skin from now, once he loses immunity in 2018, when his mandate comes to an end, the Supreme Court has already indicated they're going to continue the investigation as soon as that takes place, and so therefore he's not safe in the medium term.
Okay. It's an amazing story, and I want to thank you for telling it, because you're right. If there was the rule of law, there's no possible way that, given what you've talked about, and Temer being charged with corruption after a close aide was given, I think, $150,000 in cash, part of a $12 million in bribes. Prosecutors alleged Temer and the aide were due to receive after intervening in the business deal. If there was the rule of law, he would not be president. But by vote of Congress, by other people fearing that they too will go down in a corruption scandal, he, okay, retains office. And his popularity rating, just for people who don't know, it's about 4% or less. In other words, it's non-existent. Okay, in Washington, D.C., where we are, just blocks from the White House, you know, there's a lot of talk about the rule of law, and that's what makes America different, that America is driven by, guided by, not people, not dictators, not corrupt politicians, but by the rule of law. Whether that's true or not true, I don't want to discuss that at the moment. I think it's obviously not true. But my question to you is, why hasn't there been an outcry from the U.S. Congress about the fact that Temer has defied the rule of law in Brazil? I mean, what's the nature of the U.S. orientation towards what's unfolding in Brazil right now?
There is neoliberal plan program that has been imposed on the population unconstitutionally by Temer and company, which is one of the most savage programs of that nature that the masses of Brazil actually have experienced in the last possibly 40 years. I mean, it's taken the country back to the 1950s, possibly, in terms of, you know, losing rights and so on. The social programs have been slashed. Social expenditure has been frozen for 20 years. But I don't think that's the key to the U.S. double standards. I think the key to the U.S. is that there is a huge amount of very rich, wealthy, lucrative operations that Brazil has, such as the oil industry, which are being privatized. And I think that's where their double standards come in. Remember, the United States, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was criticized for supporting the dictators of Somoza in Nicaragua, he said the following. He said, well, allegedly he said, he might be a son of a bitch, Somoza, but remember, he is our son of a bitch. It seems to me this is the case. The United States supports dictators absolutely all over the place, and there are countries and regimes and governments that actually apply double standards. This is one of them. It should be extremely hard on them, particularly because the whole political establishment in Brazil is ganging up against a metal worker called Ignacio Lula da Silva, who all he wants is to be the president in order to continue the good work that eradicated poverty to a large extent in Brazil, who did very good things and made the economy grow so much for about 20 years nearly. And all he says he wants to do is to continue. And they are ganging up against him. The whole persecution, there is literally inquisitorial persecution organized by a guy, Sergio Moro. And the reason is this. they want to make sure that Lula is not part of the competition when the presidential election comes in.
If Lula runs for office for president again in 2018, would he win?
Well, at the moment, he's running in the polls in the region of between 25 or 35, depending which polls you consult. And the second person that comes below that is in the region of 9-11. And so far, he keeps going up in the polls. What I was saying regarding double standard is the people, the good people in the United States, you know, the political establishment in the United States should complain bitterly about the way Lula has been treated, because every principle, every minimal judicial consideration has been violated in order to persecute him. And nobody says a thing except the people in Brazil and people around the world expressing solidarity. And this is the nature that you have one, on the one side, you have Temer, you know, saving these kings by a corrupt kleptocracy that votes for him, and then everybody is persecuted who has committed no crime. So far, there is no evidence whatsoever to demonstrate that Lula is guilty of anything.
Temer has lost six ministers, six, to scandals last year, and there have been investigations into another eight agreed to by the Supreme Court judge this year. There's no condemnation of this in the United States, as we're talking about. Then you look at like neighboring or nearby Venezuela, where the U.S. government seems to be so 100% committed to the overthrow, the carrying out of regime change against Maduro in every possible way. Talk about that. Talk about what's going on regionally and what's going on in Venezuela.
Well, Venezuela is blessed and cursed for having the largest reserves of oil in the planet. And the United States is absolutely determined to lay their hands on it. And the obstacle to them obtaining this is the Bolivarian government of Maduro, before it was the Bolivarian government of Chavez. And they've been trying to overthrow that government using every imaginable pressure, legally, illegal, criminal or otherwise, since 1999. In 2002, they actually organized a coup d'etat, which succeeded for 47 hours, and the people, by mobilizing, managed to restore democracy. And the United States has never stopped. It's funded, you know, channeled huge amount of money, millions of dollars have been channeled to Venezuela to support opposition, Golpista organization in the media, political parties, and so on, to overthrow this government. And the double standards are absolutely unbelievable. The one thing the United States doesn't like is national sovereignty. Venezuela is totally sovereign to take its own decisions regarding its political system, which some people might not consider perfect. But, you know, the United States system is not perfect at all. The very fact that Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, and Donald Trump was the one elected, is an indication of how undemocratic the system in the United States is. But as far as I'm aware, Latin Americans are not ganging up, organizing destabilization in the United States to rectify, with inverted commas, that sort of problem. And the United States is doing exactly the opposite. And if you look at the comparison between the United States attitude towards the Temer government and the attitude towards the Maduro government, you know, it couldn't be more stark. It's absolutely determined to doing everything, even to the point of, you know, people dying, people being burned in the streets, which it supports, and so on. With the case of Brazil, not even a comment.
I'm glad you mentioned the thing about the American elections, because you're right. Donald Trump lost the election. He lost by 3 million plus votes. He won because of the archaic electoral college that's a leftover from the days of slavery. But the U.S. government, I mean, the U.S. Congress, the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, they don't say it was the electoral college. They say it was Radio Sputnik flooding the airwaves of Americans, making them, I don't know what, vote in the popular vote more for Hillary Clinton. I mean, it's just absurd. But I want in our last 2 minutes to ask you about this. The new report from Venezuela is that the Maduro government overcounted the number of people who voted in the Constituent Assembly, and the corporation that had created the electronic voting machines, the chief executive from Smartmatic, has now said that there was, according to the evidence that they've determined, less than a vote count that was a million less than what the Maduro government said. And now the credibility of the Constituent Assembly is being sort of tarnished. The Venezuelan government says that's not true. That's a lie, that this person, that this chief executive is actually part of the opposition. In our last little bit, can you talk about that?
Yeah, the company, actually, we just discovered, I read an article recently, which is very revealing. The company is owned ultimately by a corporation which is owned by George Soros. And this is where the problem comes. In fact, from the technical point of view, the company provided technical support in terms of software and so on, programs, etc. But the company never, ever, ever had the possibility of controlling and determining one single vote ever. Ever since it's been operating with the Venezuelan government. Otherwise, imagine, they would have decided whatever they wanted, you know, electronically. This is not possible. Only the National Electoral Council actually has control over the number of votes because this company, Smart Technique, doesn't have them. And what the government has decided to do, or the National Electoral Council in Venezuela has decided to do, they're going to do a full audit. Because it's totally auditable, different from the Plesby side organized by the opposition, where they actually burned all of the electoral material on the 16th of July. So nobody knows, you know, can confirm their claim of 7 million. So the 100% audit is going to take place in the case of the election to the National, Constituent Assembly.
Francisco, we're completely out of time. We're going to keep following this story, of course, because the struggle in Venezuela and in Brazil will have a big impact not only on their countries, but on the region and on global politics. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us at 105.5 FM every day at 5 p.m. That's Monday through Friday. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.